Ladies and gentlemen, that is the new theme music for the Leonard LoPage Show. I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm the guest host tonight. I've just decided, in Leonard's absence, to make Led Zeppelin be the new theme music. Leonard, if you're listening, I hope it's cool with you. Great song. You know, people like to talk about 1967's Summer of Love as the beginning of modern rock music and culture as we know it. But for Michael Walker, this moment came in the summer of 73, when sex, drugs, and rock and roll really took center stage. Now, many bands toured that summer, but three, Alice Cooper, Led Zeppelin, and The Who, defined the decadence and excesses of modern rock stars. Walker documents the summer of rock in his book, What You Want Is in the Limo, great title, on the road with Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, and The Who in 1973, the year the 60s died and the modern rock star was born. It's published by Random House, and it brings Michael Walker here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming in, Michael. Well, I'm going to really make you sell your case that 1973 is a great year for rock music. you've got your work cut out for you because, you know, we do think of the 60s, you know, the Beatles, Bob Dylan going electric, you know, just go down the list, the Stones. Really all over the world, we think of the 60s as being the time that rock music really came to be. Why is 1973 the year for you?
Well, it's partially, I turned 16 in 1973, so therefore everything is wonderful and tragic and comic when you're 16 years old. But I also think that the early 1970s and 1973 in particular was sort of an area of transition where we're coming out of the 60s and sort of the hippie ethos and the sort of everyone's loving each other into the 70s where money is being made. I mean, Peter Rudge, The Who's manager at that time, told me that when Woodstock happened, that made a big difference because it showed the rock world at that point, the rock industry and the record companies especially, which had been a cottage industry, just how big this audience was. And that audience, supply finally caught up and demand in the early 70s. A second thing that happened was the baby boom generation is seen as a monolithic thing. There were two factions of it. I was in the second faction, born in 1957-58. There was 18 million people in North America born that year, and they were all coming of age in 1973. And their musical tastes were radically different than people that were only 2 or 3 years older than them. So they brought to prominence, my generation, my part of the baby boom brought to prominence, Alice Cooper, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, Uriah Heep. I mean, a whole string of bands that were appalling to a classic baby boomer race.
Jethro Tull.
Jethro Tull, yes. Yes, Aqualung-owning guy. So guys that I grew up with who had showed me Cream and Disraeli Gears and great 60s music could not stand Led Zeppelin. Danny Goldberg, their publicist, said you could not believe how uncool Led Zeppelin was with the traditional rock critic guys from Rolling Stone and things like that, because they were the older baby boomers. So these were bands for us, for my generation, my part of the baby boom. That's, I think, what helped kick them over the top was the numbers and the money and the popularity of the music.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that the summer of 73 created the modern rock star, but what about, you know, some of the earlier guys? Like, I mean, the Beatles were rock stars, right?
Yeah,
but they were pop stars?
Yeah, they were rock and roll stars and pop stars. These guys were a whole different sort of animal. This was this is when you started getting backstage buffet and catering riders in the contracts for the show. So specifying not just Courvoisier, but Courvoisier VSOP, you know, Chateau Lafite Rothschild wines, contractual obligation to provide limousines with no writing on the sign, black Cadillacs only. I mean, the specificity of the demands for luxury accoutrement backstage and on the road and in the recording studio were unprecedented. At the same time, you have a differing drug culture coming through in the early 70s. You're going from LSD and marijuana being the predominant drugs to cocaine. And cocaine brings with it a whole different mindset, shall we say. And that really blew out in the mid to late 70s during the disco days. So it was just getting going in the early 70s. And that was the rock star. The rock star didn't have as much feel for the audiences, shall we say. They started hurting. In the 60s, bands were playing at the Fillmores in smaller halls. In the 70s, they upscaled these to arenas, and they took out the chairs on the main floor and called it festival seating, which sounds joyous and fun, but it was cruel, and it was a way to maximize the profit from a hall. And by the end of the 70s, more than several people had been killed at the concert.
Right, because Cincinnati with The Who.
Yeah, Who being the prime example. That was a festival seating concert, and there was a stampede at the door, and people were crushed to death. So the security at concerts, which was non-existent in the 60s, if you look at Woodstock, there's a big stage and there's big barriers, but it's not so much us and them. By the 70s, it had kind of gotten into we're stars, we're here for our per diem, we're here for the box office, we love what we do, we love our music, we love our fans, but just you're out there, we're over here.
Right. Well, so the distinction you're making, you're really talking more about an economic change and a lifestyle change rather than arguing for the music, aren't you? Because, I mean, there was some good music being made, but everything I'm hearing you say is all about, like, now there are limos and now there's cocaine, and that's what made this a great summer.
I'm giving the music short shrift.
Okay. Well, what music did you like?
Well, Dark Side of the Moon came out in 1973.
Okay, I've heard that
one. Which is an irrefutably classic album. Houses of the Holy is, in my opinion, Led Zeppelin's best music. And you have to buy into whether you're going to like Led Zeppelin or not, or you're going to like some of these bands or not. And I do, and I think that they're worthwhile bands. The music has certainly held up over the years. Jimmy Page was a once-in-a-generation guitarist and especially a record producer. The changes that Jimmy Page wrought to the record industry, not just the money, but the creative process, was only equaled by people like Les Paul in the 50s, who brought in multi-track recording. Jimmy Page really laid the template out for hard rock music, which is still somewhat in play in a recording studio today. So very influential bands all the way around, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about you talked about the economics. What was the scale of, say, a rock musician? Like, to compare, like, the Yardbirds, right. Jimmy Page's previous band.
Yeah, where he made no money.
He made no money. So he's playing with, and the Yardbirds cycled through Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, and Eric Clapton at
right.
different times. So that was a pretty good place to be a guitarist, I guess.
Yeah, it was a good finishing school.
Good finishing school. So they made no money. And they were not. How were they traveling? They were traveling in a bus. They were traveling in a coach.
They would travel by bus. They would travel by. I mean, they're also the Yardbirds. Early enough, they were still doing Dick Clark caravan tours, where there'd be like 10 vans on a terrible freezing Greyhound bus rented from somebody. They would travel by air occasionally, but it was very chaotic, and the money was just being left on the table wherever they went. They weren't playing big enough halls for it to be profitable.
Okay, and so So fast forward to Led Zeppelin. Jimmy mm-hmm. Page now has a better job.
Yeah.
What was the luxury life like in 73? What was his deal? What was his rider?
Well, the rider for Led Zeppelin was this. Peter Grant, their manager, was very influential in the rock business because he insisted on doing... Promoters used to take much, much bigger cut of these paydays for the concerts, and Peter Grant changed it to 90-10 splits. Led Zeppelin was going to take 90% of the gross of every concert, and the promoter was left for 10%. Alice Cooper's road manager, David Lieber, told me what that meant was a promoter wouldn't make any money on a 14,000-seat hall until he sold the last 1,500 tickets. So that's how slim the profit margin became. So the grosses on these halls in 1973 typically would be around $40,000 to $50,000 a night, which is a pittance compared to today. But they were taking 90% of that 30 days a month. So do the math, and that was good. Jimmy Page also had, through Peter Grant, a much better contract with Atlantic Records. They made the first Led Zeppelin record themselves, much the way independent movies are made today, or mainstream movies now. You make them, you take them to the festivals, then they buy them. They made and recorded that album on their own dime and sold it to Atlantic Records, and therefore they had far more control over the finances, over the artistic decisions, and the album covers. So a lot of artistic freedom and a lot of financial benefits accrued to the band because of the business decisions made in the early 1970s.
Well, it's the summer of 2013, so we're going back 40 years now to the summer of 73 for those listening. And I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to Michael Walker about his book What You Want Is in the Limo, which is all about being on the road with Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, and The Who in 73. I want to talk about The Who in a minute, but first let's get to Alice Cooper, because it doesn't seem to me that Alice Cooper is the kind of artist who could have even had a career before this arena mania, because his act was all about theater. It was all about spectacle, and he was like the American glam rocker that really did this before Bowie and before the other guys who could put on really a theatrical, conceptual show. What was he like? What was his trajectory before? Like, I can't even picture him playing in a club. Like, what was he doing before this whole... arena rock, before the demand for arena rock existed?
Well, Alice Cooper was, first of all, a five-member band collectively called Alice Cooper. And this is causing big trouble on their tour in 73, which I can get to in a second. But
I did not know that. The band was called Alice Cooper.
The band was called Alice Cooper, and they came out of Phoenix. They were a bunch of track and field letterman guys, and they moved to L.A., and they were trying desperately to get signed. And Frank Zappa signed them essentially as a novelty act, and they made two records with him, which utterly failed. But they really... went through the ringer, and they had a very good Led Zeppelin had Peter Grant. Alice Cooper had a manager named Shep Gordon, who was very shrewd and also had nothing to lose. So they they, between Shep Gordon and Alice Cooper, they decided to do a very aggressive theatrical show. They used to play, they used to open like the theme to the Patty Duke show. And they were famous for emptying halls in their early days. They were the most hated band in L.A. And Shep Gordon took all that negative publicity and then spun it into positive feedback for the band. He could take bad stories about the band and make people come wanting to see them because they were so bad. But the funny thing happened on the way to 1973 is they got to be a very good band. They're very underrated.
Good songwriting.
Oh, yeah. Michael Bruce, the main guitar player in the band, wrote some of the bigger hits for that. And Alice Cooper was a really good lyricist. His lyrics are funny and topical. A lot of those guys are journalism majors in college before they went out on the road and became rock stars. But, I mean, Alice Cooper in 1973 is talking about stilettos and razor blades and limousines and guns and things like that. And lyrics like that weren't being written. The song Elected, which was a big hit in 73, which was about the 1972 election, and he was running for president beautifully, and he said, "I'm your top prime cut of meat. I'm your choice. I want to be elected." I mean, that's great wordplay for what was existing back then. But they were a very good, credible, tough rock band, and that's sort of the trajectory that they came through.
Now, of these three acts you're talking about, Alice Cooper, Led Zeppelin, and the Who kind of stand apart because The Who really was a 60s band. I mean, they came together as, you know, the High Numbers or whatever, you know, whatever their original incarnation was around 1963, 64.
Yeah.
And they, you know, Tommy was their big smash in around 68, 69, somewhere in there. But by 73, they had really become like one of the loudest bands in the world and were like a huge arena rock band. So you can argue, well, yeah, they were a top grossing band and they were very excessive and there were lots of drugs and all of that. But I would argue that this era was really bad for The Who. That, I mean, this really marks their creative decline because if you listen to their recordings, Quadrophenia, which has a lot of fans, and I'm a fan of Quadrophenia, it doesn't hold up compared to Tommy. And, you know, Who's Next is a better album than, you know, Who by Numbers, for example. So, you know, can you sort of, I mean, that's why I'm having a little hard time with 1973 as a great year for rock because it seems like it was a great year for the rock business. But for rock music, I think for The Who was the beginning of their decline into kind of a dinosaur act, an inconsequential rock act.
That's a very good point. The reason I chose all three of these bands was because Alice Cooper was at their peak that year. Mm-hmm. Million Dollar Babies was their creative peak, it was their commercial peak, and they broke up 6 months later.
Mm-hmm.
Led Zeppelin, people differ on this, but I believe Houses of the Holy was their sort of the peak of their trajectory. And then they began a long and very torturous decline after that. Although they made some good music after that, it was never the same. The Who was in a very interesting position, and you're right. Quadrophenia was also their watershed. This was Pete Townshend. Pete Townshend at that time was absolutely consumed by the fact that he thought the band had become dated, that he thought they were 60s relics. And so Quadrophenia was his way to take all their history from the 60s and tie it up with a nice bow.
Right, because it has the mods versus rockers, and it has all that early 60s stuff.
So this was a complete labor of love for him. It was his attempt to save the band. I think the recording succeeds, but his attempt to make the band current and relevant failed. That was really the last time they were sort of in step with the times. And then they gradually get less, and as you were pointing out, less and less in step with the times. So this was a real tragedy for Pete Townshend because he loved the band and he loved what they had done, and he was trying desperately to find a way forward into the 70s. What he didn't realize that he could be playing, you know, the Super Bowl, or he could take Quadrophenia on the road that they did last year with the remnants of the band, that the material connected so strongly with a large enough generation that it still exists today and it can still be used.
Right. Although I read in his memoir, he bemoaned the fact that they were, The Who, ever since Tommy, they were looking for another stage piece that could replace Tommy, and they never did it. He wrote this thing called Lifehouse, which is the craziest thing, although it resulted in a great album of Castoffs, which was Who's Next.
Who's Next, precisely.
But all those songs, Teenage Wasteland and all that, were supposed to be. That Lifehouse, for those interested, is one of the craziest ideas for a rock opera ever, but that we'll never really see that come to pass because it made no sense. my question is, at what point in this, if 73 was sort of the fulcrum, at what point was it clear that rock music was becoming sort of sloggy and corporate? I mean, if this was the time when they were really kind of discovering the money and discovering the luxury, was it setting the stage for just sort of corporate rock and bands that were, you know, just for sort of phoning it in, and were there the seeds of that in this summer? Could you see the seams beginning to show?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write about it. There was a movie came out a few years ago called The Last Days of Disco, which is a fantastic title. This is sort of like the last days of what had been for rock and roll, and this is now you're going into the 70s, and you have, for a brief time, this is a window that only lasts from around 73 until 76, 77, because what happens is these bands all got bloated and they made too much money, and in L.A. it just went off the charts with the singer-songwriters are doing the same thing, the Jackson Browns, everyone else, there was lots of cocaine, there was lots of money. The Eagles. It had gotten quite decadent, and they lost touch with their audience. They were not communicating with their audience anymore. So what came next? Well, punk came next and knocked these guys right off their pedestals.
Write that book.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Michael Walker about his book, What You Want Is in the Limo. It's published by Random House. And Michael Walker will be reading and signing books at Book Court Thursday, July 25th at 7 p.m. More information is on our show page at WNYC.org. That's the real me in Quadrophenia. By the Who. Michael, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Right. Thank you very much for having me.